And here's the thing about curiosity. It's not always a positive state. So when you query the monster within, you're not going to necessarily feel good, but you're going to feel potentially more knowledgeable and more wise. And we have to widen the palette of possible outcomes beyond just well-being.
Please listen carefully.
Welcome to Critical Conversations, a podcast for lifelong learners who like to get deep. I'm Abby Henson, a qualitative criminologist searching for ideas on how to become a more cohesive, healthy, and compassionate society. If you found yourself wanting to have thought-provoking, deep, and sometimes difficult conversations but just didn't feel well-equipped, this podcast is for you. This season provides a 10-step toolkit for having critical conversations guided by my interviews with neuroscientists, psychologists, sociologists, and more. Let's learn together. Welcome to step 3 of the 10-step toolkit to having a critical conversation. Episode 1 taught us how to become self-aware. Episode 2 taught us how to address our personal biases. And now we get to become curious. Today, we get to learn from Dr. Todd B. Kashian, a professor of psychology at George Mason University and a leading authority on well-being, curiosity, courage, and resilience. He's published over 200 scientific articles, with his work cited over 35,000 times. His books, Curious and The Upside of Your Dark Side, have been translated into over 15 languages. His writing has appeared in the Harvard Business Review, National Geographic, and other publications, and his research is regularly featured in media outlets such as The New York Times, The Atlantic, Fast Company, and Time Magazine. I was so energized by this conversation. It was fun, the ideas were exciting, and I feel like now I just have more questions, which I guess is a sign I'm becoming more curious. So I hope that you find this episode as impactful on you as it clearly is on me. So let's get into it.
So I'm Todd Kashian, and for the past 4 years, I've been working with the Well-Being Laboratory that I founded, and I've been interested in the things everyone wants to talk about at parties. So curiosity, love, passion, flow, happiness, meaning and purpose in life, principled rebellions against dysfunctional social norms, friendships. And I really got into this from the back end, where I went to grad school to study how do people develop panic attacks and why. And we would put this Hannibal Lecter mask on people and induce them with 35% CO2. And about 15% of people develop panic attacks right in front of me. And then I'd be there with my clipboard and ask them a bunch of questions. And this is what I wrote down in my first year of grad school: residual unsatisfied curiosity. And that was, is that when these people were experiencing panic attacks, their heart was racing, their galvanic skin response was active, they were sweating, their lungs felt like it was capsizing. And I wondered, what were they not exploring and doing in terms of their interests because of the concern of having a panic attack or being in the midst of a panic attack?
And so, okay, I have a lot to get into on that, but before... what got you interested in panic attacks in general? Like, what led you to that research?
Yeah, I mean, I had public speaking anxiety when I was in grade school. And then I worked on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange in Wall Street. And it's intense. I mean, if there's an earnings report by Apple, there's a lot of frenetic activity going on the floor. And you can get panicky if you feel like you don't have the skills. And I was just very intrigued of like, what happens to you physiologically? Like, what is the evolutionary value of you sort of blowing up mentally for a 5 to 15 minute period? And so that's what made me want to understand it and then help people prevent it.
Yeah. I remember, so I got my 2 wisdom teeth out, and this was maybe 10 years ago, and they gave me nitrous oxide. They gave me laughing gas. And I remember either the doctor or the nurse who gave it to me said, at some point, this might feel really intense. I want you to just ride the wave. And I remember at the moment where the intensity kind of ramped up, I was like, oh shit, you know, like, and then I remembered, okay, actually, let me just ride the wave and kind of approach this with curiosity rather than the fear and the, because when you have that fear, I think you said something in the book about how curiosity is the antidote to defensiveness. And in right. my opinion, defensiveness is the child of fear and anxiety, right? It's this child of insecurity in a lot of ways, in my
opinion. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. And so that fear and insecurity is then defending me against, well, what is this thing? And putting this wall up, where if I could dissolve the wall and just approach with curiosity and ride the wave, it makes it so much easier and so much more enjoyable.
Yeah. I mean, there's a book that I read when I was in college called The Tibetan Book of the Dead. And it was the idea if you're going to take nitrous oxide or any substance or really any adventurous activity, is you need someone there who's going to be your guide, who's not doing it, who's doing exactly what you experienced in the dental office and saying is that this is going to be an unusual experience. Know that I'm here. I am basically base in a world of tag. So you can always come back to me if you feel it. And then I'm going to be watching you and I'm going to be telling you how awesome you're doing, how amazing this is. And I'm going to write down what the experience is for you. And I think a lot of times we miss these characters in our lives because we don't know how to intentionally pursue someone to be a guide in our lives. We pursue stimulating people, interesting people, complimentary people, people that are like us. But maybe it's worthwhile thinking about what roles are we looking for characters in our lives, which would take us in a different direction about intentionally pursuing your social network.
That's so interesting. What would be the characteristics of a guide?
Well, to me, they are emitting stability. So their goal is not to make you laugh or entertain you. Their goal is to basically be a receptor for whatever it is that you're experiencing. And a lot of people are trying really hard to kind of be entertaining, and they want their value to be, I don't know, rewarded in some ways for them. And the guide is a background character, but it's only momentarily for particular experiences.
Mm. So would it be like an altruistic person then, where it's self-interest isn't necessarily the guiding force, but the intention of being a guide? Like, does a guide have to want to be a guide?
No, these are great questions. So I think of this as a personality trait state situation here, where we're talking about personality states. Momentarily, there is someone who is invested enough in your well-being or flourishing that they will take a moment out of their lives to be there specifically for you. So altruistic moments. And in some ways, I view this as a father of three daughters. Is when I go out with my kids and they've never had this experience before, their first concert, their first ball game, first time traveling to a new city. My primary interest is being their guide, that they have the best experience possible, because I have more moments of traveling under my belt.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So let's, before anything, how do you define curiosity?
So there's two ways of doing this. There is your Oxford English Dictionary approach, and that's where we can get simple. We should start that way. So it's the desire to seek out new information and experiences. And it's really like this preference for novelty and this willingness to seek out this novelty. Now, if you go into the psychological world and you synthesize what have we learned over the past 60, 70 years, you find that it's a little bit more complicated. And that the simple way of me taking all of this research into two questions that humans ask ourselves, and if we say yes as an answer to these two questions, that means that we are experiencing curiosity. So one of them we know, one of them gets ignored. And this changes the whole conversation about curiosity. So just as a caveat, these aren't things we think about reflectively. They're automatic, they're fast. And they're often implicit, not explicit. So the first question is, so I'm coming in to have a conversation with Abigail and I've never met you before. So one of the questions that I'll ask myself is this experience going to be new, interesting, mysterious, uncertain, ambiguous? Is there going to be a conflict between avoiding and approaching? Any of those things that I say yes to, I'm on the path to being curious. And that's the dictionary definition. But the second question is, do I believe I can handle the anxiety of confronting the new? And if you don't say yes to that, you're not going to be experiencing curiosity. That's where you get that residual unsatisfied curiosity of someone in the midst of a panic attack, where I see that there's novelty. I see there's potential for growth of talking to Abigail. I have no idea what she's going to say next, but I don't know if I could handle this. And in this way, I'm not fully present. I'm not really in exploratory mode. I'm more in protective mode in the moment. So here's where it gets interesting. It's the perceived ability that you could handle the anxiety and the new. So you don't even actually have to have the skill. So actually you hit the exact right term, right? Efficacious means like, I think I can handle this situation that I'm in. And so a kid can be highly efficacious, but be really low in terms of their ability. And that's okay for this thing called curiosity. Now, if we're talking about being the pilot of a plane, we're talking about a medical surgeon, we don't just want efficacy. We want pure skill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, okay. When I was reading your book, The Art of Insubordination, one of the things that kept coming up were the recipes and kind of the steps that you're giving in terms of these are the things that you can ask yourself. And these are like, it was all these really great tangible steps. And one of the questions that kept coming up for me is like, there has to be level or there has to be a step that precedes it that incentivizes an individual to want to ask those questions or leads them. I guess maybe the lead is your book, right? Like if there's someone who is willing to read this book, then they may be the person who's willing to ask these questions of themselves or to incentivize themselves to ask questions of themselves. But there's something that I'm trying to get at in terms of cultivating curiosity. Like, how do you cultivate curiosity?
So there are a number of interventions that, I mean, I'm obviously, as a scientist, very interested in what do we have evidence for. So one of the ones, there's this female Polish psychologist from the, I think it's 1950s, and she doesn't get that much attention. They call it the Bleigernik effect in honor of her. And that's that when we are interrupted in the middle of doing something, or we finish something before we're actually done. So Hemingway talks about the way that he wrote was he was always end his writing session in the middle of a sentence because he had something to start the next day. Love it. It's such a great piece of advice. But think of the same way for conversations. You're hanging out with someone in person or on the phone. The idea of finishing midway through something and there's a teaser of like, okay, I crave coming back to you because we have unfinished business to take care of. Now, even just thinking about that, you start to realize like, oh yeah, yeah, that's how like, that's movie teasers. You watch a 2-minute teaser and then you want to go see the movie. Now, a mistake that a lot of film directors have kind of done is the teasers are too long. And so you've already filled my interest. I've reached closure. I don't need to see the movie anymore. So they were better when they were shorter. Less is more, interrupt in the middle of things, and you are more engaged. And here's the beauty of the Bleigernik effect. You think about it subconsciously between what you just finished and the next time you re-engage. And so you've got your wheels turning about how you perform, what else can you do, what else is out there, what else is Abigail thinking about? Oh my God, I got to go through the archives of her podcast if this is what it's like talking to her and sort of just hear her voice. And so the intrigue happens by you not bringing things to premature closure.
Yeah, whenever I'm with my dad and we're trying to choose a movie, we'll watch the trailer. And after a minute, he's like, stop it. Yeah, let's just watch it. I can't engage anymore. So I definitely get that. And that piece of advice, I did not know the name, and I didn't even know it was established. But I, in my own writing, I've been really trying to be conscious of that. Because whenever I end a writing session in a bad way, like if ever I'm like, that didn't feel great, I feel disincentivized to like to re-engage in the writing after that. So I always try, if I'm like in a flow, I'm like, all right, stop it. Even though I feel like, oh, but I want to get it out, I try and be really mindful of stopping in that flow so that then I feel excited the next time. So that resonates.
Yeah. And also think about this. It's something where I have a little bit of dislike for TED Talks. They are too prepared. They're too organized. It's got from beginning to end. You can feel that it is designed to be a package with a beginning, middle, and end. So when I teach or when I'm giving a talk to an organization, I like to end on a provocation. And so the very first class that I just finished, as we're talking now, it's the beginning of my semester. I ended the first class with, here's a thought for you to hold on to as we go into the next class, which is, if you were to rank order yourself of all the students at the university, what percentile would you put yourself in terms of your sense of humor? And everyone started about to answer. And I was like, no, you don't answer. Just hold that. We'll start the next class with that. And that's going to be our segue into talking about the science of well-being. Just a playful provocation. And what's going to happen? A few things. Well, I'm anticipating this is what's going to happen. One, people will be thinking about it. One, people will be talking about it to other people. One, people will be repeating the question and asking other people about it. And then fourth is, I may have forged the initial beginning of a few friendships in that class as they walk out like, hey, what percentile do you think you are that goes in there? And all of that was planned by me by the very simple thing of this Bleigernik effect.
I love that. I'm going to do that in my next class. Just end on a question every time. Do you continue that, or is that just a first class activity?
Oh, like, no. Like, I have a Substack called Provoked because I always end with provocations. Okay. I don't end with like, here's everything that we know about money, right, and happiness. It's always a question that I don't know what your answer is going to be. So it's like the choose your own adventure. It's interactive between me and the audience.
Yeah, I love that. I want to get back into this idea of curiosity as the antidote to defensiveness, because this is something I'm finding in my romantic relationship. This is something I'm finding in my work and in conversation with people who have differing opinions. I remember, and this is also how I feel like I've tied it back to the idea of fear and anxiety, is I remember I was in Philly, walking on a treadmill, looking out the window at a park, listening to a Michael Pollan podcast episode interview. And he was talking about, and I'm sure people are familiar with this, but he was talking about the NYU study where those who had been diagnosed with terminal cancer were given LSD trials, and they were guided, so they had the guides. And this one woman had, I believe it was stomach cancer. And in her trip, in her acid trip, she saw a monster inside of her, and she was immediately fearful. And the doctor or the guide, whoever it was, told her, rather than running away from the monster, ask why it's there. Ask what it knows and what it can tell you. And I remember hearing that and being like, oh, okay. Like, everything in my life, just approach with curiosity rather than fear, because fear is often in the unknown, right? Like, we fear the unknown. We fear the anticipatory stress that you described of, I don't know if I'll be able to handle this. That's anticipatory. We don't actually know that. And so a lot of this is fear of the unknown. And so, yes, it takes that level of confidence that you described of like, I think I can handle this, but also even approaching that question, can I handle this or not, with curiosity of being like, what would it be like if I couldn't handle it? Or what would it be like if I could handle it? And how amazing would it be if I could surprise myself that I could handle it, even if I thought I couldn't?
Yeah. So that, I mean, since cancer runs in my family, that's a very powerful example. The idea of like approach. And here's the thing about curiosity. It's not always a positive state. So when you query the monster within, you're not going to necessarily feel good, but you're going to feel potentially more knowledgeable and more wise. And we have to like widen the palette of possible outcomes beyond just well-being as like high versus low, because it could be all over the place. When I think about curiosity as the antidote for defensiveness, you think about like some of the moral and political divides in the country and in the world. And one of the trends, societal trends that's been bothersome to me is, I didn't name this, it's like victimhood narcissism. And it's the idea of identifying as being offended and upset by other people, but not taking that step that you're describing, which is querying, hey, I'm just curious, like, what was your motivation in saying that? And your tone of voice is almost more important than what your verbal attitude is in that situation. And so if you approach someone that bothers you with what they said from a place of curiosity, the first thing that happens is their defenses come down, and they might, and the first response you might get is like, oh my God, I had no idea. Like, you don't know what their motivation is necessarily, even if they have a track record of being aggressive, quarrelsome, annoying, troll-like. With you in particular, you don't necessarily know. And so it's worthwhile to potentially open up the portal to having a conversation. The best case scenario, you improve the interaction, your relationship. The worst case scenario, you end up being the Desmond Tutu or the Mandela in that situation, in terms of you took the high road. And later you can talk about how they were problematic. But in that moment, to give away agency and to give away a sense of empowerment, to be upset when you don't know, because as you said before, there's always like a little girl, little boy inside every one of us. And so you don't know if that's the one that's leading, or if it's someone that really truly despises you, the group that you're a part of, demographic you're a part of, the beliefs that you care about. And it's a simple antidote. I don't want to oversimplify and say it's easy to get there. It may require you, depending on who you are and your background and your experience, to actually take that deep breath, realize a lot of emotions are swirling right now, and it might be hard for you to phrase it that way, but you just have to squeak out that one question and you might transform the nature of the interaction.
Totally. One of the things that you gave in the book were I think there were four kinds of questions that you can ask. There was the topic switch, the mirroring, the rhetorical, and there was one more. But these different kinds of questions that can be asked in those moments to cultivate curiosity, but also to perpetuate a conversation. Oh, and to heighten your like social likability.
Yeah, this is Julia Minson's work. And it's really powerful because we do a lot of mirroring where, like, I'm not that into sports, but I'm a guy who looks like they do sports because I work out. And so my entire life, I've been treated like I'm a bro when I'm a nerdy guy who likes statistics and psychology. And so I've learned to be very good at mirroring. But really, it's branching, extending, and really topic switching is really an important element of asking questions. I mean, one of the things that I've loved in my adult life is watching people who are extremely good at doing 90-degree switches in the conversation of, listen, I've loved that we've been talking about psychology. Can I take us in a different direction? And when they ask that question, if you say no, it's like, why are you even there with another human being? So I started copying that strategy because it's really beautiful in terms of, it's also in terms of you're inducing the movie trailer. Of like, God, like, here's my hand, wherever you want to go, I'm going to go, because it's just a conversation that goes there. And if you think about this as a listener, this doesn't happen that often. And so it's really like a beautiful high-level social skill that we don't take advantage of.
Yeah, totally. I love that. I was thinking about one of the things that, again, of this like inducing curiosity or cultivating curiosity. And I was just thinking, one of the things you say in the book that like really struck me was that creativity is not an innate gift. It's a way of thinking. And I think that often we think of these things of curiosity or creativity as these innate gifts that people have, that you're just an innately curious person or you're an innately creative person. And what I'm realizing in this very moment as we're speaking is that what you're kind of saying with the guide, I think of also the concept of an expander, right? Someone who exposes you to these ideas to then open your mind to, oh, that's possible. Oh, that's a way of doing things, right? There has to be some level of exposure prior to engagement to know what to do or how to do it. I think there are certain people who are, of course, innately talented in certain things. But I do think that for most of us and for most things, there has to be a guide in a way, right? Like that's why we go to school. Like we need to be taught certain things. And I don't think, like one of the things I say in my classes is, man, I don't care if you know names or dates or facts coming out of here. All I want you to do is be able to be a critical thinker by knowing how to ask questions. Like that is the only real skill that I want you to walk out of here knowing is how to ask questions of others and yourself. Because that, and I think that, you know, in some ways I can serve as an expander for that, but I do think like it's important for listeners to recognize that like if you don't feel like curiosity is a skill that you have, it is something you can hone, right? It is something you can learn and something you can get better at. It's not just yes or no, I'm curious or not, yes or no, I'm creative or not.
Yeah, I remember reviewing The Science of Curiosity because many of the books that exist, they talk about when you were a toddler, a preschooler, you ask thousands of questions per day, and then it just winnowed down to now it's as an adult, like asking 25 to 50 questions per day. There's no science for this. All the science points out is that curiosity is relatively stable until about the age of 65, where we tend to have a little bit of a drop on average in the population in terms of being open-minded and curious. But it tends to be quite high. And as you're describing, it's a series of habits and behaviors. It's just like going to the gym. Everyone has an innate ability to build a bicep, a tricep, and have some cardiovascular activity there. You can run for a quarter of a mile and chase someone that stole your wallet. But you have to build that skill and just show up in the gym on a regular basis. And in the same way, for curiosity, it's really just a mindset that you enter into. And we can talk about all the specifics of how to do that, but you captured a few of them right there. One of the things is, if you're at a workplace meeting and everybody talks about diversity and how many perspectives are in the room and you have newcomers, you have people that have been there for 20 years, but if no one opens a forum to allow those new voices to offer partially developed, incoherent ideas in the room, it doesn't matter what you say. There's no guide. There's someone that's telling you, this is what we care about. But there's not someone that's opening the door and saying, this is what I want us to do right here now in the meeting. And most people are not in workplace meetings where someone's saying, what? I don't feel like we've gotten the newcomer's voice before we make this decision. I don't feel as if we've heard from people except for the same three people who eat up 80% of the air in the room. I haven't been in those meetings. I haven't facilitated meetings where those existed in the aftermath. And I think we spend so much time talking about what we care about, but we don't get into the mindset of actually doing it when we are in an actual situation. For the workplace one, there's a relatively simple strategy that's actually been out there for a while in terms of you should be collecting everyone in the room's ideas about the topic or the decision. Maybe you're deciding to make a merger. Maybe you're deciding to increase the number of people that you hire. Get everyone's opinions ahead of time, anonymized, so you don't know who said what. You get those ideas in the room, they're on pieces of paper, everybody gets a Word document, and then everybody talks about which ideas that they like, which ones that they want to build on, and then only later do you reveal who is the messenger as opposed to the message. And in this way, seniority doesn't matter, prestige doesn't matter, your gender and race doesn't matter. It's basically just the quality of the idea later. And then afterwards, towards the end, you start giving credit where credit's due in terms of who initiated the idea, who built on the idea. And then, so you have all the benefits of making sure the best decision-making process is enabled and everybody gets credit, but not in the wrong order.
Yeah, the order. That's interesting. One of the things that you spoke about that I think was helpful was the idea of the psychological flexibility and this idea of escaping pain or hunting meaning. And I'm wondering if you can speak to the listeners a bit about that.
Yeah, the psychological flexibility dashboard is really four questions to help you navigate a challenge, a difficulty, or obstacle in your life. And that could be, you might be at an impasse in your relationship with your partner because maybe you've been together for over 7 years. We know that tends to be a little bit of a dip. It may be that your kids have aged out from being cute and loving, and now they're like annoying 12-year-olds to 17-year-olds. No experience there whatsoever by me. Or maybe you're just bored at work. You've been there for 20 years. You make a good income and you've accomplished a lot of things. And now you're just treading water. So here are the four questions. They're prompts in order. The first one is to figure out an inventory about what capabilities, strengths, and abilities are inside you. What do you value? What do you care for? Who are you doing this for? And it may be just about you, but most likely you're probably trying to make somebody proud. Maybe it's your primary caregivers. Maybe it's your sibling. Maybe it's a social group that you feel like you are barely hanging on and you really want to be a member of this group. Whatever it is, it's for you. So you write that down. And what strengths do you have? What's in your arsenal that makes you special compared to other people? This is where I talk about, I think narcissism gets a bad rap. Is that I often have this provocation when I give talks or workshops, which is, what would your life be like if you had zero on a 100-point scale of narcissism? Zero narcissism, like not the slightest iota, nothing there. And the conversation tends to lead to is that I would be not writing the book that I want to write. I wouldn't be saying the things that I want to say. I definitely wouldn't be saying it if I was around people who I thought were socially attractive, really physically attractive, who I thought were cool. You want to have about 15%, 20% on a narcissism scale. And it just means that you're basically walking through the world saying, I got a lot of strengths. I work hard at them. I'm ready to deploy them. They should be shared with the world. Kobe Bryant was like this. Sandra Bullock's like this. Michael Jordan was like this. So that's question one. What's in your arsenal? What do you value? Who are you doing this for? The second question is basically, what's getting in the way? Like, what's popping up inside you that's interfering with your ability to make forward progress? And this is where you have to be honest with yourself in terms of self-defeating thoughts. What are they? Sensations. Maybe when your heart races, you really pull back. Maybe when you're the last person that walks into a room, that you feel really self-conscious about it and it gets in the way of things. The third question is, what are you doing to get rid of those unwanted thoughts, feelings, and sensations that are interfering with you pursuing these aspirational goals? Now, this is where it gets interesting. There tends to be a superficial list of what's good and what's bad. So on the bad list, superficially, we have alcohol, we have excessive eating, we have being verbally aggressive towards people, self-injurious behavior. And then on the good side, we have, I work out, sexual activity, playing video games. And the thing is, form of what you do doesn't matter. If it serves the function of avoiding contact with those unwanted thoughts, feelings, sensations, things that are seemingly good can be problematic. Going for a run and going for a workout could be a way for you to escape the thoughts that you don't like about yourself. Socializing with other people could be a way of, I just don't want quiet. I just don't want solitude. So be careful on this list of, think really carefully of, like, What are you doing to cope and escape, even if other people are telling you, God, you look so good and healthy and you have such a good social life. How can I be like you? You yourself know whether those things people are envious of is just because they see the outsides and not the insides of the experience. So that's the third one, is basically, what's your list of coping strategies? And then the fourth one is, what can you do differently to chase your values, to work in a way in the world where you are doing things to seek out aspirational goals, promote the best that's inside you, as opposed to trying to prevent errors, mistakes, and failures. So you're going promotion focused as opposed to prevention focused. How can you change your habits? And that tends to be the hard list. You don't get to question four until you work your way around of, one, the inventory of what's in your psychological and social arsenal. Two, what's interfering with you? Three, how are you coping with those things that are interfering? And then after, what are some alternative habits you're willing to experiment with and explore with?
I love that. Do you feel like, so later you talk about this concept of self-distancing, which is kind of putting yourself in a third person and kind of identifying the difficulties that you're having with, I don't know if you necessarily say this, but the way I perceived it is like with an empathetic tone. And I'm wondering, do you see, because you don't necessarily speak of them in the same section, but do you think that doing the dashboard in a self-distanced way, like in a third person, of being like, what are Abby's strengths? And then what are the things keeping Abby from, do you feel like that could be helpful? Or is it a more internal, eye-focused exercise?
Oh, no. I mean, Abigail, you hit it. So self-immersion would be under question three. What are you doing right now to cope, and maybe not as effectively, with these unwanted thoughts, feelings, sensations? We do need to be very self-immersed, which is, God, Todd, you talk way too much when you're on these podcasts. Damn, you're always trying to make it playful and funny, and sometimes it's serious topics. I mean, Abigail brought up cancer, and you were actually playfully and smiling. So I'm like self-immersed, and it's very self-denigrating. It's like there's something wrong with me. Whereas if I switch to what you said, question four, what can you do differently? It would be self-distance. Is, Todd, why are you always being playful in when you're talking about serious topics? Just the idea that I've actually created some space is that there's me, the person, and there's me, and there's these thoughts and words that pop out of me. Because there's some distance there, I can look at those thoughts, I can look at those words, I can look at my style for how I interact. And if I don't like it, I'm not attacking me. I'm just attacking output that comes out of me. And really sort of separate, it's more of like, what am I doing versus the doer is messed up, screwed up, anxious, problematic, neurotic, and aggressive. I'm focusing on the things I do might be anxiety provoking, aggressive, but it's not me, because there's a part of me that can look at it, thinker, and the thoughts. Because I can do that, I create some space where I can make some really good progress, that self-distancing strategy.
I was just thinking about an argument that I've had in the past where someone has said, like, you're acting like a dick. And the person's hearing, you're a dick. And the difference there of, like,
yeah,
the identity and the action, and taking that on as like a total self-criticism, when how can we distinguish ourselves from our behaviors? And I think it's really hard to do that.
Yeah. And I don't want to skip to higher, more complicated things, because this is something that is a lifelong mission. I was watching Survivor with my 11-year-old daughter, Violet, yesterday, and the woman got booted out. Her fire got snuffed out. She got booted from the tribe. And then she like got pissed off, and she like smashed the bushes and like threw something into the air. And she's like, Dad, that's what you would do. Like, you would be like really aggressive if you got booted out of the tribe. And I complimented her and I said, I love that, because you didn't say, like, just to go to your point, you didn't say like, God, Dad, you're such an angry person, you would do it. She's like, that behavior is like what you would do. And so because she used a distancing strategy to describe me, I'm not defensive. I'm like, yeah, that's what I'm probably do. And they'd probably pick me to be on the show because they would love to have the happiness researcher throws a, you know, a pissy fit like on public television. Like they would love that happens there. But that even my kids are picking it up where not only are they getting better at describing themselves in a way of it's not me, it's my behavior. They're doing it on me. And this is how you break the gridlock of seemingly intractable problems between people that think differently.
Yeah. So, okay, you say that you were working on Wall Street and you were experiencing some anxieties and this led you to want to explore these things. What is it about you that led, like, that you chose that path to explore it? Why, how did you cultivate a level of curiosity in yourself to then be like, yeah, I want to know the research. I want to know what is happening here.
Well, it's interesting. So let's do the longer version of like, why choose science versus being a journalist or an author right away? So I picked up a book when I was working on Wall Street that was by John Lilly. It was his autobiography called The Scientist. And anyone who's experienced a flotation tank, that was designed by John Lilly in the 1960s. And he basically injected himself with ketamine long before it became popular. And he developed a chart from studying himself in terms of what leads to a K-hole where you experience this complete dissolution of the self and you can observe yourself completely independently versus you go too far and it ends up an obliteration of and even the ability to even think about the self. And he had this study where he did, it's such a great study, it's worth repeating, even though it takes us on a tangent, where he hired this Swedish model to live with a dolphin for a year and wanted to know, can a dolphin and a human form a cohabitating relationship? Because dolphins form lifelong friendships. They're one of the few species to do this. And it went terrible because dolphins are very hypersexual creatures. They were living in a house that was about 1.5 feet of water. And so she developed like gangrene on her legs after living there for a year. And then the dolphin was constantly like rubbing up against her. And it was this terrible, amazing, but horrible experiment. And I was reading this and I'm like, oh my God, being a scientist, this is not what they talked about in grade school. You can do this and like collect data and write about this. And I was like, damn, I want to be a scientist. So that was like part of the operation in my head of like, you can study anything. And you have this ethical review board to make sure that you don't do what John Lilly did.
So Lilly was your expander.
Yeah, he was. I mean, he's still my hero. I mean, even though you know he at that period of time there weren't institutional review boards in terms of like evaluating the ethics of. But I mean, it was an interesting exploration, and I wish we could still do studies like this. I mean, Jane Goodall couldn't do what she did in terms of living with chimpanzees. Because she invaded their social hierarchies as a human.
Right. So why do you think this whole season of this podcast is about critical conversations, how to have a critical conversation? Why do you think that curiosity may be an integral component of having a critical conversation with someone?
Because most of the time we skip a stage, we go to perspective taking. So you as a woman, if we're at the gym separately at 1 o'clock in the morning for a 24/7 gym, we have different experiences. I need to take your perspective of like, as opposed to thinking it's the same thing. You just pick out what body parts you work out. There's dangers that go on there that maybe I might not be thinking, experiencing. And that can go with every person that's not like you, different gender, different sexual orientation, different part of the world you grew up in, with parents, without parents, adopted, not adopted. So we skip perspective getting and we jump to perspective taking. And curiosity takes us, goes back to more to the origin story of like, listen, I can't assume I know what your perspective is until I sufficiently explore where you're coming from. And so if you say, Todd, listen, I am totally not a fan of the idea of trying to bring everyone into the room to speak at a meeting, because then meetings will take forever. So that's your, I've taken your perspective, but I didn't get your perspective. So if I'm like, if I can explore more openly of, hey, I bet Abigail is a really smart, critical thinking woman. She's teaching critical thinking to students. I bet you there's a really deep motivation she hasn't unearthed yet in words, and try to get that there. In there, that's the magical sauce in terms of there is a strategy to do something that I don't know yet. And so if we can get perspectives and then only then go to take perspectives, we can find out that there is more commonalities and more differences among all of us. And there's beauty in both of them. And we shouldn't be leaning towards, I want us all to feel like we're all similar. That's a problem. I want to only focus on differences. Well, now it's hard to form coalitions that happens there. It's really like having this dialectical mindset of to truly leverage your strengths and make the group smarter and wiser. I need to understand what is your profile. Like you're going to have a unique profile. You have spoken to people I'll never speak to. You have the books that you've read, the movies that you've watched, the things that your parents have taught you over the years, what your experiences were being excluded and included over the course of all those mandatory years of schooling. You have a perspective to offer that is unlike anyone else on earth. And I think we just assume way too quickly that we got someone down because we can get a couple personality traits right. You're high in extroversion, you tend to be agreeable, you're in the middle in terms of neuroticism. Like, I got you down. No. You don't. And that's curiosity allows us to have a more holistic approach about people. And thus we can create and bridge things that didn't even seem possible before you get those perspectives.
So the animalistic, natural, innate, evolutionary need to stereotype, right? The need to put people in a box quickly in order for us to gauge whether they're a threat or whether they're... So there's this like underlying fear that is then kind of, to go back to what we were talking about at the very beginning, there's this like underlying fear that's then leading us to have that perception, right? To think, okay, I know who this person is, in order to, for me then to feel safe, right? I get you.
Yeah.
I know what you are. So now I know how to approach you. And so again, that the need to stereotype in that way is almost an act of defensiveness because you're defending the underlying animalistic evolutionary fear of uncertainty, right? I don't know if this person is going to kill me or going to hug me, right? And so I need to figure out very quickly who they are, what their intentions are based on what I've seen in the past, what I've internalized from the media, all these things. And so again, going into your statement of curiosity as the antidote to defensiveness, it's breaking down that evolutionary need and again, necessitating some level potentially of confidence to know, even if they might try to kill me, I might have the skills to defend myself, but I'm not seeing a knife in their hand right now. So let me lean in a little, right? And so I think there has to be, I think what you're describing is exactly what you're saying of curiosity as the antidote to defensiveness in gathering information rather than projecting an assumption.
I love that this entire podcast is on this one single phrase. No, it's great because it. So one is the evolutionary mechanism of finding friend or foe. And then the supplement to that is, are you part of my group or could you be part of my group? Or are you part of the outgroup and thus don't belong there? And this is where you get this black sheep phenomena, is the most despised person is someone in your group that questions the group in terms of what you're doing, what you're thinking, and what your objectives are. People hate this so-called disloyal member of the group. And one of the things that I've been really interested in is the black sheep are basically the progenitors of innovation. The reason that groups last the test of time and evolve over time as the world shifts is because of the black sheep who say, you know what? Like maybe we should be a little bit more open to allowing people that are religious, and conservative, because where are they supposed to go if very highly liberal universities and colleges are saying, we don't like this political belief system? But where are they supposed to challenge their beliefs? Where are they supposed to learn new belief systems if not in educational systems? So this has been like an accidental mission of mine in terms of how can we be more allowing of them to come in, because I don't want them to be radicalized outside of these places that happen there. And this is a conversation that still is not sufficiently had. And it's because a lack of openness and curiosity towards the other, this othering that happens there. And go back a few years and it was women. Go back a few years before that and it's people of different races. And not that this is all happening simultaneously, but I really think it's worthwhile to ask in group settings, what subgroup, what faction are we showing unnecessary bias or prejudice towards? And if you are a school, if you are a park, if you are an athletic team, it really should be, unless they are intentionally malicious towards other people and you really have high levels of psychopathy, you really should be open to anyone that's willing to be a potentially good group member. So this is where curiosity becomes to actually opening these doors and having more permeable boundaries of who's allowed and in and who you're excluding.
Yeah, I think I would need like a whole nother hour to get into that, because I think that there's so much nuance there and so much important unpacking in terms of, yeah, like, especially thinking about the radicalization component and when we exclude what that does. And then, but also how to hold accountability in those spaces as well in a way that is not demonizing, but is productive. So for the listeners, we kind of have given some, or you've given some great tangible tools, and I just kind of want to jot it out, let it be super simple. So paths to curiosity, right? What are some of the tangible things that our listeners can do? We spoke about the self-distancing. We spoke about the dashboard. Is there any other kind of tangible skill?
We had the Zeigarnik effect, underappreciated women in science. I mean, one of the other ones is the first woman to get tenure at Harvard University, Ellen Langer, had this really underappreciated study in the 1980s where she wanted to know how kids can be more inclusive, not her language back then, with children who were handicapped. And the way she did that was it was like a decathlon of events. It was like skeet shooting and darts and lawn bowling. And one group was just given the list of activities and saying, and you were asked, who do you want to choose? Everybody has to do at least two of these sports. And the other group was told, there might be hidden strengths that you're not aware of every member in the group that you might not know by looking at them. So you have to choose. Everyone has to do at least two sports. That second group, just one pager, and just said, there might be hidden strengths that you don't know by looking at someone. They would ask those kids who are blind, deaf, in a wheelchair, hey, here's a list of things. Like, what do you think you could do? And guess who is the best person for pin the tail on the donkey? Yeah. Which kid is the best person? Someone that's blind. Their whole lives, they basically been navigating the physical world without sight. Why would you ever pick someone who's loud and athletic versus someone that's blind? It's not even close to it. But the only way you think about that is you have to break the confines of how you think athleticism looks like. Insert your favorite Serena Williams, Caitlin Clark. You know, you have these iconic characters. None of them show a disability. But once you open the door of like, what does a disability buy you that you hear you are coping through the world with a loss of a sensory modality? So I just want to say that one of the paths to being curious is to ask yourself constantly, like, what am I not getting by only focusing on the veneer or surface level of a person, thing, or idea?
Yeah. And also then that allows for probably greater finding of commonality too.
Oh yeah.
In some way. Yeah. I love that. Okay. Rounding it out. What are the three things outside of curiosity that are, or what are you curious about, I guess, but what are the three things keeping your attention right now in the world? Either a book, a show, a podcast, some activity, something that's keeping your attention.
Oh, it's a great question. So one is I'm working on my first children's book. So I am now obsessed with reading children's books. With my 11-year-old, I just thought that during COVID, we started of just generating ideas. And it's now out with publishers right now in terms of shipping around. But I'm interested in, after all these years of studying well-being, let me go a little bit earlier. So now I'm interested in elementary school level kids, of creating books where through stories, it's kind of like Ayn Rand with philosophy. You don't have to like Ayn Rand. I know people hate Ayn Rand, but she did have a love story to showcase her objectivism philosophy. And I thought, what if I created really cool, fun stories where adults could like it just like kids, kind of like The Simpsons, but in children's book form, because most children's books are incredibly uninteresting. And then each book would have a psychological concept that I'd be teaching to children. So that's something that's been huge. The second one for me is I'm obsessed with purpose in life. So I'm really interested in the strange, off the beaten track ways that people find purpose. You know, the guy in India who's riding a rickshaw, and that's his purpose is basically to afford candy for his children. And then on the surface level, you think it's riding the rickshaw, but it's really of, this is a very simple path where I can get afford candy for my kids on a daily basis. And then the third one is I'm sort of obsessed with Suits, but bear with me for a second, which I know almost every guy is when it showed up on Netflix. I just started watching it because I am constantly intrigued of how people automatically assume someone is a bro. This is both men and women. And when what that means when you box someone into this category, and what that means in terms of what are the avenues that you have to disprove that you're a bro? Like, is there even a way out of this boxing that occurs there? Like I described before, is that because I work out, I look like one. And if there was a video, you would see that I look like a bro, but I hate talking sports. I don't like hanging out with people to drink, and I don't go to breweries, and I tend to be like a very nice guy who loves big, deep conversations. And so like, what are the pathways to get out of this framework?
Do you just redefine the bro to include those characteristics?
Yeah, I mean, bro has a purpose because it does characterize a very clear person that you meet on spring break when you're in high school and college. So I do want to keep the category, but I think it's been broadened and I don't know if there are sufficient escape hatches.
Okay, well, we'll hope that you find one. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me. This was really great. I would love 100 more hours.
Oh, you listen, your knowledge of evolutionary psychology, like your inserts about the human mind, like I could talk to you for days.
Cool. Well, thanks again. We'll end there. But yeah, this was so enjoyable. I really appreciate it so much. Thank you so much for joining me in my critical conversation with Dr. Todd Kashtan. This was step 3 in this season's 10-step toolkit to having a critical conversation, and I hope that you loved this episode as much as I did. There's going to be a live Q&A with Todd following the release of this episode, so follow What's Just on all social platforms to stay up to date on when that's going to be taking place so you can get your questions and comments in the mix. Links to all socials can be found in the show notes. And please don't forget to subscribe, share, leave a review, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with step 4, how to create a safe space. So stay critical, stay connected, and I'll see you next time.